case number 10-5057, American Bar Association versus Federal Trade Commission appellant. Mr. Bergman for appellant, Mr. Harris for appellee.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Michael Bergman, and I represent the appellant, Federal Trade Commission, in this action. I respectfully requested 3 minutes for rebuttal time. This case presents a single issue, whether the District Court erred in holding that attorneys are categorically exempt from being subject to the important identity theft provisions of the Fair and Accurate Credit Transactions Act, or the FACT Act, and the Commission's Red Flags Rule, regardless of the nature of the billing agreements that they have with their clients. The Commission applied the Red Flags Rule to lawyers who defer the payment of legal services based on the plain language of the FACT Act, which included not just designated financial institutions, but it incorporated a very broad activities-based...
In the past, when the FTC has sought to use broad language to regulate the legal profession, for example, we have said that there needs to be unmistakably clear evidence that the Congress intended to do that. What is your unmistakably clear evidence that Congress intended this act to reach the legal profession?
Your Honor, if you're referring to the Gremlich-Bliley case in which this court held a few years ago that attorneys were not subject to the Gremlich-Bliley privacy regulations, we would submit...
Actually, I was referring to the ABA versus FTC case. That's
correct. For one thing, the plain statement rule in that case from Gregory versus Ashcroft came up in the analysis of the Chevron Part 2 analysis. There was no general principle of statutory construction whether lawyers are covered under federal law. And indeed, doing so would run counter to a plethora of cases, including the Heinz case, the Goldfarb case, and the Milovitz case, which attorneys have been subject to federal law if their activities fall within the statutory coverage. Therefore, in the Gremlich-Bliley case, the plain statement rule of Gregory came in an analysis of the Chevron Part 2 analysis, but there was no sort of threshold or general principle of statutory construction of whether lawyers are subject. And further,
are you saying we don't look at the unmistakably clear language until we get to Chevron 2?
I would say that the plain, as a threshold matter, the plain language here, in fact, does cover lawyers who defer payments, just like any other service provider. So if our argument here is that the plain language of the FACT Act, which incorporated the broad activities-based definition of credit and creditor from the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, the plain language, frankly, does cover lawyers who defer payments.
But that you have to assume that a lawyer is included under the phrase any person.
That's true, Your Honor.
That was supposed to be a joke. Thank you.
We submit that they often are, sometimes are. But in fact, it's a very broad term. You highlighted a key point here, distinction with the Gremlich-Bliley case. Here we're talking about the activities-based definition, very broad, that said that from the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, that talks about any person who regularly extends, defers, or continues credit, compared to the Gremlich-Bliley case, in which this court, frankly, had some difficulty putting in attorneys into the term financial institution, particularly solo practitioners or the practice of law. This court also supporting that was this notion that a business of a law firm is a practice of law and not a financial institution as defined under Gramm-Leach-Bliley, which is an institution, the business of which is engaging in financial activities. This case is also, in stark contrast, as I've touched on before, the operative term here is credit and creditor from the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, which talks about any person that defers credit. It's a very broad activities-based definition, and whether an attorney, if they are a person, which they sometimes are, if they do in fact defer payments for legal services, they do fall within the statutory definition.
In your view, is any deferred payment credit?
Our position is that we have laid out, as we've noted in our frequently answered questions and in various publications to the public, that there are certain categories that are or are not credit. We have noted that monthly billing is in fact a deferred credit, which runs very consistent with the interpretation by the Federal Reserve Board staff and case law that monthly billing can and should be deferred billing.
That's monthly billing. How about any deferred payment? So I get a haircut and leave my wallet back in at Chambers and say the barber says you don't need to pay me till next time you're here? Is that credit?
The commission has not taken a position with respect to every single type of deferred payment. And in fact, this is not
regularly.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Statute talks about regularly.
That's right. The statute talks about regularly deferred. The standard here is whether an attorney or any service provider regularly grants the right to defer payment regularly. So we're not talking about the particular billing or particular circumstances of a particular client, but whether the attorney his general billing practices regularly allows monthly billing on the one hand, which would constitute credit, versus regularly only does or accepts contingency payments or retainer payments, which they would not extend credit.
Now, what about the statutory terms accounts?
The ABA has brought up the terms accounts, the terms customers, as being sort of examples of that why attorneys should not be covered. In fact,
in other words, it's any person, but it's within a context of, this is my question, accounts, customers, et cetera, where there is regular extension of credit.
Attorneys have accounts, Your Honor. Simply, when an attorney bills, in terms of their billing or their customer relationship with their client, if the bill that goes out, if it's a monthly bill, will often have an account number on there. Payments that come in for outstanding debt, for outstanding bills, will come into the accounts receivable department of a law firm. There's nothing inconsistent or unusual about attorneys providing legal services on the one hand, but in terms of their billing or the customer relationship with their client, having accounts. Often there'll be an account number on the top of a billing statement. Again, there's nothing inconsistent about that at all.
Not that it should matter to our disposition, but aren't there proposals in Congress to clarify this issue, and is the FTC proposing anything as well, or you just?
There are some pending bills in the House and the Senate. We understand that there is a new bill that's currently pending that may substantially affect the coverage of attorneys and other service providers, but it has not passed, and we will let the court know when that passes. We understand.
Is the FTC contemplating anything along that line, or are you just running hard on this interpretation?
Well, the FTC is
go
acting.
Go big or go home, right?
The FTC is acting, has been in discussions, as I believe the ABA, with legislators as well. But again, it's uncertain about whether legislation will in fact pass. If legislation passes, which it may very well soon pass, and we'll let the court know about that, we obviously.
No, I was getting at whether the FTC is considering under its rulemaking authority maybe defining this in a way that wouldn't be so broad.
The FTC is not, contemplating a new rulemaking procedure, but it will act certainly pursuant to the new congressional mandate if that comes down.
I want to be clear on your response to Judge Griffith's question about the test that stated in our opinion. And it is true that it appears when the court is discussing step two of the Chevron analysis. Is it your position that the language there and the Will case on which it relies simply doesn't apply in this situation, since we do have these federal statutes that apply to attorneys?
Our first position is that in fact, if an attorney, like any service provider, does defer payment, in fact, it does fall within the plain statement rule. So, in fact, it does cover. Our position.
Congress wrote the language so broadly that it just sweeps in everybody.
It would sweep in everybody, Your Honor. In fact, to give you a good example of that, before the court here, supporting amici include the accountant associations and the doctor association supporting the ABA. They also have sued the commission, the district court, essentially asking for the same exact relief and making the almost identical arguments about why their members should not be covered. There's in fact no principal distinction between separating attorneys on the one hand and accountants and doctors and pharmacists and engineers and social workers and thousands of other service providers or professionals who might defer payment incidental to their core business. Again, Congress intentionally rejected much narrower interpretations or definitions for entities covered by the FACT Act in the legislative history that were basically limited to traditional financial institutions like insured depository institutions, and instead incorporated two very broad categories: financial institutions, primarily involved in the financial sector, and a very broad activities-based definition of equal credit, of credit and creditor from the Equal Credit Opportunity Act.
Suppose we disagree with you that there's plain meaning. I'm not sure I understand. What are you saying about the commands of Gregory v. Ashcock? If we disagree, there's no plain meaning here, the way you suggest.
We would say that again, that this case is not dictated by Gregory in terms of, well, first we would say that it is, in the sense that if attorneys defer payment, they fall within the category. Because
I'm saying we reject that. Let's say we reject that. We do not find plain meaning to support your position. So now I'm trying to wonder, in your analytical framework, where are you now going?
If you do not find
Gregory there, which talks about state sovereignty, lawyers are normally regulated by the states, we have to take that into account, there must be a plain statement from Congress in order to vitiate the control that states otherwise have, what are you doing with that now?
Well, if in fact, for one thing, we would say that there is just simply not the same kind of interference with state regulation that there was, that animated the court's concern in the Gramm-Leach-Bliley case. Gramm-Leach-Bliley was very concerned with the fact that the non-public personal information involved in Gramm-Leach-Bliley interfered or overlapped with client confidences, and that state bar rules had already sufficiently protected that sort of information, and the district court and this court were clearly concerned with interference with state regulation of attorneys. In this case, we...
States don't regulate in this area? That's not my understanding. I'm asking you, is your understanding different?
States regulate generally the licensing and regulation of attorneys. They certainly do, and we are very candid in saying that states have primary responsibility in that area. However, we're talking about the billing or customer relationship between an attorney and a client, and in fact, the ABA here admits that there are no state bar rules that are specifically designed to protect the victim of identity theft. These kind of consequences that are similar to what the commission is trying to protect here in its red flags rule. There is simply no interference with or overlap with state bar rules that animated the court's decision in the Gramm-Leach-Bliley case. I understand I've run now into my 3 minutes of rebuttal time. I can answer further questions or answer questions on rebuttal.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, my name is Mark Harris and I represent the American Bar Association. There are two reasons why the FTC's policy is unlawful and beyond the FTC's statutory authority. First, in ABA versus FTC 1, this Court held that a federal statute should not be understood to regulate the practice of law unless Congress so provides in a clear statement. Here, there is no clear statement that Congress intended the FTC to regulate the practice of lawyers.
Any person isn't clear? How could you make it more clear?
Two things, Your Honor, about that. First of all, the any person is not the only language in the statute. The statute defines it as any person who is a creditor. Creditor is defined in terms of regularly given credit, and credit has a very technical definition, which I'll get into in a minute. It's the right granted by a creditor to a debtor, the right to defer payment.
And no lawyers do that under any circumstance?
It's possible, Your Honor, that there could be lawyers.
And if it's possible, why don't we do this on a case-by-case adjudication of whether a lawyer is a creditor or not?
The distinction between this case and other cases where this court has applied statutes or the Supreme Court has applied statutes to lawyers is that here we're talking about the regulation of the practice of law, not merely that the statute covers lawyers, such as other cases that the FTC cites, but it's actually regulating the practice of law. It's actually having a direct and real impact on the way attorneys interact with their clients. That's what makes this case different. Even if the words any person were to apply to lawyers, the point is that there is no indication that Congress intended to regulate the practice of law, which is exactly what this statute does. The FTC has applied this statute in such a way that there could be, in every case according to the FTC, where a lawyer has a new client, the lawyer must ask for personal identification in the form of a government ID. The lawyer may have to monitor the client's activities to make sure the client isn't engaging in what the FTC considers to be red flags. And the lawyer may actually have to withdraw from the case and may have to report the client to law enforcement. Those are direct and severe effects on the practice of law. And that's exactly what this court said in ABA versus FTC 1. We should not assume Congress wanted unless Congress says so explicitly, which it very clearly did not do here.
It says so explicitly. They have to particularly say this covers lawyers as well?
It may not have to use
any person doesn't cover lawyers, but we'll make clear that the statute does by saying it covers lawyers. Is that the type of what are you requiring? It's not as if this is a group that isn't aware of the legal profession when they're legislating, right?
No, and in fact, if anything, Your Honor, I think that cuts against the FTC because this Congress knows how to cover lawyers when it wants to. Many of its members, as Your Honor is pointing out, are lawyers. When it wants to cover lawyers, it does so explicitly. I'll give an example. In the Milovic case, which the FTC cites, one of the underlying applications of the term debt relief agency actually defined debt relief agency in terms of bankruptcy assistance that's provided, and it says that somebody who provides legal representation with respect to a case or proceeding under this title. Congress knows very well how to write into a statute clearly and plainly that the statute should apply to lawyers or to people who are providing legal services.
But Congress is also aware that this is a long-standing interpretation that the Federal Reserve Board staff had given to the same language. Congress didn't do anything in the face of that.
I disagree with that, Your Honor. First of all, there's no evidence that the FTC has come up with, nor is there any evidence at all, that Congress is aware of that interpretation. In fact, to our knowledge, there are no court decisions anywhere in this country applying Regulation B. So that doctrine of legislative acquiescence or legislative reenactment only applies when it's clear that Congress knows about the administrative interpretation, and there isn't any evidence here. Moreover, we don't really know how to apply that language because it hasn't been applied. I would submit that it's not plausible that what the Federal Reserve Board staff intended to do was to change the definition of credit away from the explicit statute which says it's a right conferred by a creditor to a debtor. That's really what's wrong with the FTC's argument here. The FTC is insisting that the word right should be simply read out of the statute. To take Your Honor's example for a second, Your Honor said, what about a situation where somebody gets a haircut? Is credit being conferred? I would take the example of a restaurant, because there's something that we all know restaurants do regularly. A restaurant serves you the food first. In fact, it might actually serve a set of courses. Doesn't ask you for your credit card before you start putting your fork into the food. It waits until the end. According to the FTC's position, well, that's credit. According to the FTC's position, if I get in a taxi cab and I ride, and then at the end of the taxi cab ride, I get out, and then he asks me for the money, that's credit.
Well, if Congress passes a statute that has very broad language in it, and instead of saying, and we mean by person, accountants, doctors, lawyers, dentists, Indian chiefs, et cetera, just as any person who regularly extends credit, why isn't that the type of statute that's begging for an as-applied challenge, given that services are provided? It's not inconceivable that credit could be extended to a client on a regular basis. Identity theft is a problem that arises in the legal context.
I'll give a few answers to that, Your Honor. First of all, it's not only the any person language. It's the definition of creditor, which looks to the definition of credit. That's important here. This all turns...
It doesn't say any person who regularly extends credit other than lawyers.
No, but it says any person who regularly extends credit, and credit has a very specific definition, which other courts have interpreted.
I know, but do any of those definitions say this could not, under any circumstances, apply to an attorney-client relationship? That's what I'm getting at.
No, but the teaching of ABA versus FTC 1 by this court was that we don't look to see whether lawyers are excluded. We look to see whether they're included. That's the whole point.
I thought that's what the discussion you were having with Judge Griffith was all about. I mean, any person, if lawyers are persons, you know, what more does Congress have to say?
I think the teaching of that case is that Congress does need to say more when it's regulating lawyers, because Congress should not be understood, as this court said before, to want to get into the matter.
Do you say that about any profession that's regulated by a state? The accountants? The medical profession that's here in amicus, do they need to say that as well, or is it just lawyers?
I think there may, I don't want to speak for the other professional organizations. It's possible that there may be others that fall into it, but this court and the Supreme Court have had a special emphasis on the role of lawyers. The Virginia State Bar case, which is
funny about that,
isn't it? The Goldfarb case says that the interest of the state in regulating lawyers is especially great because of the role that lawyers play in the administration of justice. More than that, I would say that one of the points that this court made in the first FTC case...
You know, just back to your earlier point, I mean, Congress has passed some statutes that apply to lawyers and the practice of law, discrimination statutes, for example.
Yes.
That interferes, quote unquote, with how you want to run your law firm.
I don't think that they interfered in the way that this statute does, or in the way the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act case did.
I was struck by the amicus brief filed on behalf of the states. It didn't cite anything that shows that the states are covering this particular problem.
Well, it's a little bit of a catch-22. The reason why there is no specific identity theft regulation is that there is really no problem of identity theft in the legal profession.
Well, there is some problem. I mean, we have the citations in the record here.
Well, what's interesting to me is that, and I think very telling, is that the first two examples that the FTC cites are not problems that would have been addressed by the red flags rule at all. They're cases where a lawyer was transacting business on behalf of a client, piece of real estate, with somebody else, and that person impersonated a third party. There was no lawyer on that side of the transaction. The red flags rule has nothing to do with that. Those are the very first two cases the FTC cites, and they have nothing to do with the red flags rule. I think that says a great deal. To go back, Your Honor, to one of the other points you made about why isn't any person enough, I think what the court's cases teach is that we don't only look at isolated language in a statute. We look at the entire statute. Any person refers to creditor, refers to credit. Credit has a specialized definition. It's not clear at all that every single person falls into the definition of credit. In fact, the examples I gave about the restaurant prove that they don't. A further point is that there are other indications in this statute, including statements about the legislative purpose of this statute, which indicate that the goal here was not to regulate identity theft altogether. It was only to regulate identity theft in the credit industry. The language of this statute is not the kind of language that Congress would use to sweep in lawyers. Words like account holders, customers, credit or deposit accounts, transactions, that's just simply...
Well, one of the definitions of customer is client, so, right? Well, dictionary definition, it's pointed out.
It's one of the definitions that the word could have.
Customer, you can't say that customers doesn't refer to the legal profession. It most certainly does.
I think the point, it's perhaps the ninth definition, I think, that was listed in Webster's. The point of all this, Your Honor, is that what the court taught before was that there's a thumb on the scale that says the Congress doesn't want to regulate in this area. To distinguish lawyers from doctors, for example, doctors are subject to many regulations on the federal level. Lawyers really aren't. Not regulations that specifically attach to the lawyer-client relationship, not just to what lawyers do on their own, for example, lawyer advertising, but specifically to that relationship that they have. That's what this law would do, and it has the same problem for that reason that the Graham-Leach-Bliley case thought that law did.
I guess I don't understand. I thought you got your medical license from the state.
Well, for example, HIPAA, creates all kinds of rules about what kinds of disclosures of medical information on behalf of a patient there could be. There just aren't any analogies to that. And the reason why is that in the legal profession, the reason why is that there's 200 years, this very, very long tradition that says we leave it to the states not only to license, but to regulate the practice of law, to decide, for example, when a lawyer must, so to speak, turn in a client, when a lawyer must breach a duty of confidentiality or a duty of loyalty to the client. We want state authorities, state Supreme Court, state bar associations to be making that decision, not federal agencies who have never regulated in this area before. Let me turn, Your Honor, for a moment to the second point, which I addressed briefly in passing, which was that the second reason why the FTC's policy is simply not sustainable is that they've taken the definition of credit and creditor and really distorted it beyond anything that Congress could have meant. As I mentioned, credit is defined as the right granted by a creditor to a debtor to defer the payment of some obligation. They've basically written out the word right in their policy, and they've also written out any sustainable meaning to the word defer. The Third Circuit and the Second Circuit have both rejected essentially the same argument that the FTC is making in this case. In the Reithman case, the Third Circuit considered...
Okay, but that was an as-applied case. And the Third Circuit said there's no ipso facto exception for attorneys under this fact statute.
I think in that case, the argument wasn't made. They weren't saying that lawyers couldn't be excluded. They just simply said that it's the argument isn't before them. But what they did say, which I think is very telling, is that they said, in view of the statutory purpose underlying the ECO Act, it seems implausible that Congress intended to cover not only banks and other financial institutions, but also all professions. They found that not plausible. And they rejected the specific argument that the agency is making here, which is that the mere lag time between when a lawyer provides services and when the bill is due somehow inherently constitutes credit. They thought that that was not plausible. And the Second Circuit spoke even more clearly about that. The Second Circuit said to adopt that argument, that the lag between the payment and, excuse me, the services and the bill, for that to be credit, would mandate, quote, indiscriminate application of the ECO Act, which is not appropriate. Both of those courts were clearly saying that that interpretation is not acceptable. And, Your Honors, that is the interpretation that the FTC has put before this court. On page 76 of our joint appendix, that's the statement of the extended enforcement policy, which is what this court's reviewing. The FTC said that its reasons for applying this to lawyers is that lawyers provide services first and bill later, sometimes in the form of monthly billing. But they make the general statement that any time that happens, services first, payment later, we have credit. That simply is contrary to those decisions, and it's also contrary, I think, to the plain meaning of the statute. Furthermore, there are ethical reasons why lawyers couldn't adopt that model. Lawyers are, because they're fiduciaries to their clients, they have to take client monies, put them in a trust account first, and then withdraw from them after the services are performed for the client. The FTC takes the position that if a retainer were paid up front or in advance or something like that, that would be enough. Then it wouldn't be credit. That's not even correct, because a lawyer cannot draw from a trust account even if the money is put there first until after the services are rendered. So by the FTC's own reasoning, even that would be credit. I see, Your Honor, that I'm just about out of time.
All right.
But if I have no further questions, I'd like to respectfully submit that the decision below should be affirmed in its entirety. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. All right, counsel for appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just wanted to emphasize a couple of points and correct a couple of misstatements by the appellee's counsel. For one thing, with regard to the instances of identity theft in the legal field, in fact, the Connecticut Law Tribune article does cite to a number of instances where concludes that instances of identity theft in the legal profession is easy to find, and those are separate from these two cases in which they distinguish. Also wanted to emphasize an important point if attorneys are exempt from being creditors under the FACT Act, they're necessarily exempt from being creditors under the Equal Credit Opportunity Act. There's no distinction there, since The credit definition from ECOA was adopted directly into the FACT Act, and therefore attorneys could discriminate with impunity.
How do you respond to his point about congressional acquiescence to the Federal Reserve staff approach to the ECHO Act?
In fact, we would argue that the fact that the Federal Reserve Board staff 25 years ago expressly said that lawyers who do deferred payment of a bill is covered, that...
Do you have any evidence that Congress was aware of that?
We are not aware of any evidence that Congress was specifically aware of that particular...
Any court ever bought that?
With regard to lawyers being covered under...
Any court ever cited Regulation B?
Absolutely, Your Honor. As a matter of fact...
Covering lawyers.
Specifically with respect to covering lawyers,
yeah, that's what this case is about.
Though that's true. However, the principle here, again, with regard to lawyers, is no different from any other service provider.
I'm just asking a simple question. Has any court ever cited that support the proposition that lawyers are covered?
No court did. However, as a matter of fact, the Reithman Court, in fact, ignored that decision. That's one of the arguments we make about why the Reithman decision, even though, as Judge Rogers noted, is an as-applied basis, they ignored the Federal Reserve Board staff's interpretation that lawyers are covered. A number of cases, Judge Edwards, including the Larimore decision, 2005 Seventh Circuit decision, another case we cited on page 22 to 24 of our brief, did cite to the Federal Reserve Board staff interpretation of Regulation B and the ECOA about whether particular transactions are credit or are not credit. They did not specifically deal with lawyers, but again, lawyers are no different, even though they might think they are, from many other service providers like accountants and pharmacists and veterinarians here. A number of cases have in fact cited, not the Reithman case, but other cases like the Larimore decision have cited the Federal Reserve Board staff's interpretation. Going back to the point I was trying to make a little earlier is that if attorneys are not creditors under the FACT Act, they're necessarily not creditors under the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, and they can discriminate with impunity with respect to any aspect of a credit transaction. So therefore, they can allow their white male clients to pay their legal bills 6 months after the provision of services, and yet allow their black female, require their black female clients to pay immediately. And that result cannot be countenanced, and something that Congress did not intend.
Is the colleague here correct that in asserting that your principal position here is that lag time is it? That's the way you're getting to.
Again, Your Honor, we apply, the commission would apply, and again, they have asked for a blanket exemption here. We're in a facial challenge, and we have not brought any enforcement cases yet. Our position is that payment that's after the provision of services or goods is, in fact, deferral, applying a substantially contemporaneous standard, which many courts have.
The answer is yes. Lag time is your foundation.
In fact, Your Honor, the commission has not had an opportunity to because of the posture which is.
What do you do with their point that the statute defines credit more narrowly than that?
Right.
The statute
defines it as a right. The credit that they're talking about is when a customer has a right to
There's no inconsistency we will always follow the statutory definition. We would only cover, and again, we've not brought any enforcement cases yet or any opportunity for, but we...
Wait, the rule, are they right or not? I just need to make sure I understand your position on what they've said. The rule that is now being challenged is premised on the notion of lag time, right?
It is premised on the notion of lag...
So your attempt to flesh out what the statute says. It's based on lag time. And nothing more or less. That's it.
It is based on a deferral, which is lag time. That's correct, Your Honor. We have not determined the precise circumstances. We have not said publicly that if someone necessarily walks out the door, that would necessarily constitute deferral.
The only reason I'm asking that is because they have argued, not unpersuasively, that appears to be facially inconsistent with what the statute says.
We only follow the statutory definition, Your Honor. It's a right granted, the right granted to defer credit. We would only follow whatever the statute does require, and the case law, which has interpreted those terms, has imposed a substantially contemporaneous standard, and that's the sort of standard that we would follow. We would not necessarily require a deferral equals when the person walks out the door. We have not had an opportunity yet to determine all the circumstances because this has been challenged in a facial challenge. So we have stated publicly that 30 days monthly billing is a type of deferral. Retainer agreements, contingency agreements, fees for future availability do not equal credit. And yet, it is an open question, as of now, because of the posture in which this case has come up, about whether particular kinds of agreements would necessarily be a deferral of payment.
So let me just be clear. To the extent that the commission has already explained that certain types of agreements would not be covered, then that invites the legal profession simply to rewrite their retainer agreements to avoid coverage if we were to hold that the statute on a facial challenge cannot be read to necessarily exclude attorneys. Is that correct?
They write the retainer agreements that do not constitute deferral, and we've come to that position, would not be covered.
And I need to understand what's going on here. In other words, if there's a problem, and Congress was trying to address the problem by saying any person who regularly provides a right of credit, but the commission is interpreting in a way that there's a giant loophole, then I'm not sure I understand the commission's position here.
We don't believe that there's a giant loophole, Your Honor. We will always act consistent with the statutory mandate that only where...
But do you see a problem that I'm concerned about?
If it has... with respect to...
The commission says it covers everybody, all right? But if you write your retainer agreement to include these magic words, you're not covered. So everybody writes their retainer agreement except for the negligent person who overlooks it to include the magic words, so the statute doesn't apply.
If the retainer agreement essentially required payment to be made with no deferral of payment, then it would not apply, just like contingency agreements are not applied. We don't think of it as necessarily as a loophole. It's just following what we deem to be a consistent interpretation of the statute, that in that case...
One historical question. How did this come to be passed by Congress?
The FACT Act, it was to address the issues of identity, the real scourge of identity theft in any industry which provides credit, different than in the credit industry. It's to address the real problem of identity theft with regard to financial institutions and in any industry where credit is extended.
I'll look this up, but I mean, were there full subcommittee hearings?
There were committee hearings.
Full committee reports.
There was a full committee report, and the committee report rejected the more narrow entities that would be covered as financial institutions and adopted the ECOA definition of creditor because it wanted to protect against the scourge of identity theft in any industry.
Hearings, I would find that the ABA and the AMA testified, things like that. Submitted testimony.
I don't believe they did submit testimony.
So I would find all these credit companies and banks. That's what I would find. Is that correct?
You would more likely find that. But again, Congress was very clear about covering all of these entities.
Yet the commission itself didn't make it clear that it applied to attorneys. And in this town, that seems strange.
Again, Your Honor, there are literally thousands of service providers that, incidental to the core business, would provide credit, so there was no reason to necessarily list attorneys, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We'll take the case under advisement.